I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, a writer considers the imprint left on her consciousness by her indigenous Mexican roots and by the embodiment of that heritage, her fierce, passionate, and often difficult mother. Sherry Moraga was born in the 1950s into a California family that was technically bicultural. Her father was white, but she's come to understand that it was her mother's influence that shaped her, well into the older woman's decline into dementia and even after her death. We'll talk with Moraga about coming to terms with her attraction to other women when she feared her Catholic mother would disapprove, and about why her brother's relationship with their mother was radically different than hers. Our conversation starts after a short break.
Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, where researchers strive to develop sustainable solutions to protect the world's fresh water supply. You can learn more at endeavors.tcu.edu.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Sherry Moraga's mother was not the sort of person people normally write books about. She was pulled out of school by her father to help support her family, first by picking cotton on a California farm, later as a teenage cigarette girl in a Prohibition-era Tijuana nightclub. So while she spoke two languages, she couldn't read or write much in either one. She was often angry, resentful of her lack of education and of her husband, who was not a full partner in raising their three children. But there was an extraordinary strength to Elvira Moraga, even through her decline into dementia late in life. And her daughter sees the legacy she passed down as a woman with indigenous Mexican roots as a vital and lasting gift. Sherry Moraga has woven her mother's story into her own memoir, which is called Native Country of the Heart. She joins us from NPR in New York to talk about it. Sherry, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You tell us here that you didn't fully understand your mother's early life until you were forced to kind of slow down and abide with her in her final years when her mind was failing. Was it that you didn't know the details of those years, or you didn't absorb fully how they must have shaped her?
I think the second. You know, my mother was a wonderful storyteller, cuentista. So she told us many of the stories from Tijuana. And as we got older, we kind of got more and more details about it. But I think it was really later and really seeing the kind of span of her 90 years of really understanding that those kinds of, you know, experiences that she had and the hardships she's had as a young woman had really, and also particularly her experience in Tijuana and seeing this going from, you know, being a farm worker in California to suddenly being this 14-year-old in high heels in this Tijuana of the Agua Caliente racetrack, casinos, this major kind of, you know, golden era life, you know, suddenly she's thrown into a cosmopolitan world that changed her forever. And I think that it's just simply also my own age, you know, that at my own age, I began to be able to look back, you know, and really understand sort of how those were kind of absolutely significant in sort of impacting the way she really looked at the rest of her life. And nothing was quite, you know, there's a quote from the book that says, you know, how are you going to keep them down on the farm, you know, after they've seen Tijuana in the 30s, you know? And I think that was a certain struggle for my mother in many ways. She had dreams that, you know, never could quite get fulfilled.
What was the kind of relationship that she had to the club owner or the racetrack owner in Tijuana? What was like the understanding that existed between this mobster-like figure and a young woman like your mother?
Well, I mean, I think that's the confusing part about it is that, you know, there was a... My mother was a very, you know, traditional, you know, Mexicana, you know, young woman, and it really is a sense that her, the time, particularly culturally, that, you know, her virginity is basically the thing that has to be protected at all costs. That was your value, that was your worth, you know. And yet she was thrown as a young single, as a girl, into this huge world, and this owner, you know, Wirt Bowman, who was her boss. And he did many favors for the family, and when she turned 18, she knew it was the time for payback. And yet in her, of course, everything in her, you know, did not want this, resisted this. And it's an interesting story because, you know, there's two times in which he was requiring her payback, and each time, My mother's a deeply, deeply faithful person. I mean, it's not so much about the church, but a really, really deep spiritual faith. And she really believed in both times, circumstances actually interrupted that possibility. So I always kind of felt like, however you understand spirit, you know, the gods were with her because she never had to. And yet in a curious way, felt guilty that she didn't. You know, and I think that's the most interesting part really about it, or the most tragic part, is the way many times, you know, we internalize, you know, I think this is probably all women, but particularly there's a Mexican, you know, twist to this about our own shame all the time about, as women, that somehow, you know, we owe men something in that way. And he had been, you know, quote unquote, good to the family, you know, had paid for the family, the father's funeral. And here she is left without a father, without a big brother to help her, and she had to make all these decisions, negotiate those things, just as a teenager, all on her own. You know, she was a very attractive young woman, and it was a liability.
You paint this really just poignant picture of your mother as a very young child being pulled out of school by her father to work in the fields and pick cotton. She's got her little brother strapped to her back because somebody's got to take care of him. And you acknowledge that there are lots of families that had to do this because the family had to survive, but there's this sense your mother believed her father could have made a different choice.
Well, I think one thing is that they were both, I mean, both my grandfather and my grandmother, my mother's parents, were born in Sonora, Arizona. And technically, and then they came to the United States, to Tucson, but they were my grandfather was bilingual. You know, and so, you know, we've just had many years in the Southwest and then into California. So because he was bilingual, he was a kind of, you know, the way I describe him in the book, you know, sort of like a kind of Wild West guy, you know, like in Tucson, he was, you know, he was like in bar fights, and they have, you know, little news clippings of him in this kind of Wild West life. And he ended up having, you know, 11 children, and he, you know, he was a, as at one point you would call him a coyote now, that, you know, he transported people across the borders. And the border was not like it is today, but they were particularly, you know, as they were called at that time, you know, they were South Asian people, Hindus, bringing folks over back and forth. He was also during the temperance period, you know, he had a, you know, was doing, you know, was under the table, was, you know, had his kind of speakeasy going on. He was his own kind of entrepreneur, if you might want to say. And so partly with all of these children, it's not that they weren't struggling economically, they were, but to her, she felt like, you know, that when the fact that the father could make more profit, obviously, by negotiating these contracts, and he had many, many children, then it was to his benefit to do that. And so she, and also, you know, he had a problem with alcohol, I mean, all of this stuff. So there was a way in which, you know, they had a curious relationship, you know, as Mexican Americans. They were not, you know, immigrants. They were people that had been born here in the United States. They have a long history of their relationship to the Southwest, and partly that's what also connects in the book around, you know, us being native to America, you know. So he was in a little different position, I think, than other, you know, what we understand as the immigrant experience. And in that sense, and he was a, you know, he was a smart guy. He knew how to kind of, you know, move things around. And I think that she adored him. And also, you know, I learned very, very later in her life, her resentment toward him, that early on, you know, that she wasn't able to go to school because of this.
I've only met your parents through your writing, but I have to imagine that if I had been in a room with them together, I might have thought, how did these two get together? How did they get together?
It was a dance, you know. It was after the war, after World War II, and my father was doing he's always worked for the railroad, Santa Fe Railroad, and he was a telegrapher that he learned in World War II, and so he had that one skill, and that skill is what brought him, you know, into working in the railroad. But he always did, as a young man, would do graveyard shifts and all that. So before his 12 o'clock shift, he had popped in on this dance, and he saw my mom, and, you know, she was a very, you know, just a very attractive, very beautiful young woman. But by then, this was actually her second marriage, and, you know, the book talks a little bit about the first marriage, and she was already in her 30s, and because of, you know, very late in life, having to support the family, et cetera, her own love life kept getting postponed. And my dad sees her and, you know, dances with her. And, you know, her approach has always been like, well, I really wanted children. Mm-hmm. You know, she was already in her 30s, and more than anything in her life, she really wanted children. There was this man who seemed like a nice man, a decent man, you know. And that was it. It wasn't very romantic, you know. It was really, I always have sensed that from my mother that, I mean, my father's a good man, you know. But it wasn't like, you know, she really just really wanted family. And, you know, he very quickly, you know, he was much younger than my mom. And very quickly fell in love with her and took her home to the mother, you know. And the mother looked at her, and my mother was a very worldly woman already at that point because of having been the support of the family. My father was actually much more innocent than my mother. And my mother felt like that wasn't right. He was an innocent person, and she had, you know, been married before, and she also had a big life. And you know, my grandmother, Hallie, looks at her and says, oh, no, you're perfect for him. You know, and I think she realized that he was going to be in good hands, which really was true. He was in very good hands his whole, you know, their whole marriage of 50-some years.
Yeah, and he was kind of useless without her. Like, when your mother, they lived apart for some time because of his job and the work that mm-hmm. she was doing. And he kind of fell apart without her.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, too, is children, you know. I mean, I love my father very much, but, you know, you're a child and you see that. I mean, you come back to the home you had lived in and he was left alone, and it was like, you know, it was just very, very clear that that mother, that woman, was the one that was making a home and making it a family, you know. And I think those are things, because my mother had been very sick, and it was clear that if she went, we'd be in trouble, you know, because it those kinds of things as children, you just, particularly in the kind of the environment of what you understand as safe, you know, what you can rely on, who you can rely on, with the just that sense of what home is, you know. And that was completely recited in my mother, and not just for our family, not just for our nuclear family, but in many ways for a much larger extended family of the Moragas.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You write about something here that's really interesting. So your father is European, American, Anglo, whatever you want to call him. He's white. Your heritage on your mother's side is mestizo, which is to say, as far as anybody knows, like a mix of European and Native descent. But for people like you living in the United States, that kind of rich and complex identity just gets flattened into Mexican. Your Native origins get erased. Can you talk about the effect of that on how you have defined yourself throughout your life?
Well, I think that it's an evolution also, you know. When I think about my own family, partly the origins of this book for me had a lot to do with not only my mother's private amnesia, you know, with Alzheimer's, but also my fear and my lament somewhat over cultural amnesia in the United States. That sort of the price of citizenship in this country is that you have to forget your origins. And coming up in the family that I did, and that not, I mean, you know, we were, it's always such a mixed kind of message that you get as Mexicans, that and this is not all Mexicans, but there is a popular notion, you know, that we are to forget that we are mestizos in the sense of also being Indian people. And that came from 500 years of colonization. I mean, with the invention also of the Mexican nation state, which was, you know, I mean, basically the vast majority of people that call themselves Mexicans, even to this day, are mestizo people, which also means that they are Indian people, you know, that in terms of their ethnicity. And but that is pretty much, you know, through years of education and, you know, colonization, Catholicism, all of that. You are really raised to deny those origins, with some exception. And this is changing a lot now in terms of in the Southwest of people acknowledging that.
My guest is writer and cultural activist Sheree Moraga. Her new book is called Native Country of the Heart, a memoir. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERATHINK.
Support for Think comes from ArtCan, a program of the Texas Cultural Trust and Houston Endowment, whose 2019 State of the Arts report finds the arts contribute more than $5.5 billion annually to the Texas economy. More at artcantexas.org.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with writer Sheree Moraga about her new memoir, Native Country of the Heart. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Sheree, you say some of your favorite memories of childhood are of singing with your mom. What did you sing together, and what made that so special to you?
It's just lovely. It's just lovely. I mean, I think those are what I was describing in Native Country. Is just this, in Los Angeles, there's these wonderful cement tunnels that go from like Chinatown to our home at that time in South Pasadena. I was pretty little, like around 5 to 7. And those tunnels, I mean, Chinatown was kind of it was like a very big deal to go out to dinner at that mm-hmm. time in our lives. And so we'd come home and we would sing. Always my memory is that we would sing songs all the way until we got home. And my mother would, you know, it was like, you know, que sera, sera. You know, they're just, you know, there was this one, put your arms around me, honey, hold me tight. I think these were probably all from like the 40s and that sort of thing. And those are the songs, the lyrics she knew. And so we knew all we'd make little hand gestures, and it was just a really, you know, a really lovely moment, you know, in which we were all kind of, my sense of, you can do any kind of romance about the family, right? My dad's driving, and my mom didn't know how to drive, and my dad had a terrible voice, but he would chime in, and we would shut him up, you know, and my brother actually had a beautiful singing voice, and so it was just, it was one of those good moments, you know, good moments.
Your mother had a really different relationship as a parent, it sounds like, to you and your sister and your brother. Like, in each case, there was what seems like a completely different relationship.
Yes, it's true. I think, you know, partly what the book also talks about, which is difficult, I think, it's always, you know, kind of these invisible things, but you know, my brother, as a boy, you know, it's like, I think I write in the book that my mother raised my son. I mean, she raised her son as a Mexican woman. And so she, you know, even though my brother's road in life has turned out quite differently, there was ways in which, I mean, she really raised us with double standards. Mm-hmm. So he was free. He was free. He was basically free, you know. You know, to come and go as he needed. And, you know, he always did well in school and stuff. He wasn't a rebellious person, but he was free and not accountable. And there was ways my sisters and I's lives were completely the opposite. I mean, that we were, you know, raised in a very, very traditional way about as young women, where, again, as I had said earlier, that everything was about, you know, securing our virginity until we got married. And, you know, just... And so it was there, you know, we waited on our brother, you know, we made his bed, we picked up his dirty clothes, we did, you know, everything was completely, you know, I mean, that's the thing, I didn't learn that from my father, I learned that from my mother, and I think many of us can say that we, you know, particularly in you know, Mexicano tradition is that it's the mothers who are doing the domestic raising, and so they're raising their daughters so they will survive under patriarchy, you know, and... But my mother but between my sister and me, also, we had very different relations with my mother, you know, because there was a certain sort of, and this was the way it was through our, you know, through all of our life with her, that, you know, I think at one point in the book I say something that my sister was the practical person, took care of these things in the world for my mother, particularly as she got ill, and she was the one that stayed closest to home, and yet... With me, I handled matters of the heart. Hmm. And I think that my memory of doing that is since I was very, very, very young, you know. And I think in a certain part, not that that was easy, but in a certain part, I credit that for me being a writer. Hmm. Because from a very, very young age, I was listening to like sort of the internal life of a grown person. You know what I mean? That the complexity of character of human beings, you know? And so my mother confided in me, you know, and I remember being young, I didn't know what she was talking about sometimes, you know, and I just, then I grew to understand some of the things. But she also talked to me a lot about desire, and I don't just mean sexual desire, you know, and I mean, she was a very romantic person, actually, just like my sister. My sister was very romantic, but desire in the sense of fulfillment in life, you know, wanting things in life, and she was somebody, I think, that was in many ways very unrequited, even though her life looked, you know, they were, you know, working class people, but they, you know, they were comfortable people. It was okay, you know, but though something in her own heart wasn't ever fulfilled, and I knew that. I could, you know, I can swear I knew that since I was little, you know, really a young child, and sensing that from her. And so, you know, it's like, I think the portrait that I'm describing to is a complex one, you know, and what I received from my mother too is compassion. And it doesn't mean that people are right. It just means that you understand the complexity of why they come to make the choices they've done, you know, they have in their life.
It's really interesting. So much later in your mother's life, when you and your sister were going through the process of getting her diagnosed with dementia, the psychiatrist is like, oh, well, she's obviously bipolar. Did you know this? And and you guys were like, she's just always been this way. And thinking about it, you realize that anger that was maybe caused by her bipolar disorder also allowed her to sort of stay in control of things. You know, she had a lot of responsibility on her plate.
Right. Well, and the other thing is, I'm not so sure about that diagnosis. I mean, he literally was like 5 minutes in the office before she ran out, you know. And I think there's also a cultural element to that, you know. And I think, you know, this was, you know, a white man. And I think that there's certain ways in which there's a kind of a spectrum of emotion and emotional expression, you know, that is quite culturally specific, right? That is distinct, that Latinos and, you know, we're, you know, that Puerto Ricanos are different than Mexicans are, you know, it's like, but in that specificity, I think that we allow for a greater emotional expression and don't think that that's necessarily wrong, you know, or that's ill in a way that I think that some of the structures, particularly in WASP culture specifically, you know, that has, you know, kind of more rigid parameters around that. So I don't know if actually, you know, that diagnosis is accurate, but I do know that it was a lot. It was her way of managing, and her anger, you know, there's no way to put it. It was off the hook. I mean, it was unwarranted. I mean, like the cause effect, whatever had caused this emotional outbreak was usually not warranted. You know, the outbreak was not, didn't warrant what had happened, right? And so we always knew it was too much, and we often lived just with this incredible tension in the family about what was going to get her mad, what was going to explode her, you know? And that's really hard on children, you know? But I guess what my feeling about it is, too, is that, you know, and I don't know if this is just a Mexicano thing or whatever, but I really do feel that there's a relationship to suffering that also creates consciousness. Suffering can shut us down completely, and I don't believe we should suffer uselessly. But if suffering also teaches us a certain kind of compassion, maybe that's all right, you know, that not everything is about us being safe. You know, sometimes it's in those sites where we are uncomfortable and we don't know what's going on that is our road kind of to ourselves, you know, to figure out. It's through those conflicts we figure out who we are. And I'm in no ways, you know, advocating like that children should suffer, like even the way we suffered. But I don't know, you know, I think that on a certain level it did teach us a certain sort of courage, you know, in the world, you know. So it's always... And I think I'm speaking also as not just as a person, but also as a writer, in the sense that, you know, you have to look at these are things that we're not always fixed in this life. We don't always get fixed. And so also what you want to look at is, you know, how people take those broken situations and make, you know, something beautiful from them, you know. And so, you know, Elvira was rough, you know. She was really rough. And it was incredibly painful for young children to go through those things and, you know, complicated in terms of me and my own road that I had in front of me. But, you know, I guess that's also, you know, we don't love necessarily just fixed people, you know. We love how they come to us, you know.
How were you braced? What kind of response were you braced for when you told her that you were attracted to women?
Oh, well, you know, that's a really important moment, I think, in the book. And because it's, you know, I think that was the worst possible thing that could happen. I mean, obviously what I'm talking to you about is a relationship with this woman that to me meant everything, mm-hmm. that home, family, everything resided somehow in this body of this person. And I knew since I was quite young that, you know, that I was, you know, now that, you know, people say queer. When I was very young, I think that was accurate to say it queer because, you know, I was a tomboy and all of that. But also I had this sense about, you know, pretty early on about fearing that I was, because I was such a tomboy and stuff, to really know, I just thought that I was, you know, I was raised very Catholic, so all of those obsessions that you think you're going to hell, you think you're marked, I mean, those were horrible, horrible. That was my own quiet, you know, quiet battle that I never told anybody about and would wake me up in the middle of the night and I'd be praying and locking doors and doing this to keep out this devil that was in me, you know. And so coming, so that's one thing. Catholicism does one thing. So when I kind of got through that part where I wasn't going to be condemned, you know, I could be free. The other part of my mind, as I said, I guess that's going to mean I have to leave my family because there's no way my family, my mother in particular, is going to be able to accept this. And so the day before I leave, I'm leaving the Los Angeles. You know, I'd been out for several years, but in a very closeted life from my family. Not that my mother didn't suspect. And then so the day before I'm leaving, we have this phone conversation. And I'm due to go see my family, you know, the next day to say goodbye and all this. And I tell my mom, oh, yeah, I'm going to come in the late afternoon or something. And then she says, why are you coming so late? You know, we never see you anymore. And you're leaving and you're just going to give us a few hours? Well, that's all I'd been doing, is just giving them a few hours because I was trying to keep my other life away. And she did the best thing she could have done in life, you know, where she says to me, you're leaving with a secret. And that completely disarmed me, you know, because I knew she knew, you know. And I could either be really a coward and not be the brave person she was, which was to ask me in that way. Or, you know, I could leave and that would be it. And she knew that would be it. She knew that I was leaving in such a way that I would have a life separate from her. And, you know, it was that critical moment. And she was really right, because I thought never in life could I come out to her. And she asked me that, and I said, well, this one you can't accept. And so it's described, the scene is described in the book, but I think the most important part of it was her response, which was, how could you think that there is anything in this life that you could do that you wouldn't be my daughter? And that's everything. You know, to me, that's everything. That was this critical moment in my coming of age. That's really my coming of age moment. It's not coming out politically. It's not, you know, it is really the moment in which you give your parents and your, you know, in this case, my mother, my mother gave me the opportunity to be myself. She asked me to be myself, to tell my truth. And I told her my truth, and she still loved me. And to me, you know, I've taught for many, many years, and I've taught a lot of young queer students and, you know, a lot of Latinos. And I say to them, from that lesson, is that give your parents a chance to love you, not who they think you should be or not who you think you should be for them, but to love you. Give them the chance. And if they reject you, well, at least you tried, you know. But I think so in many ways, you know, we decide that in advance, and it takes so many more years to be ourselves, you know, in this integrated way. So my mother gave me a great gift, and I think that sometimes in all my years of writing, and sometimes people say to me, oh, you know, how do you have such courage? And I don't really feel that about me, but in response to it, I always say, you know, I'm loved. I was loved, you know, for all the trouble and all the pain and everything else. It's like there are moments in people's lives in which really, really bottom line moments occur where you it's a judge of character, you know, who people really are. And I felt like my mother came through for me in spite of every part of her that was just, you know, so against it, you know, and so afraid.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's go to the phones now. We have Giselle on the line in Austin. Hi, Giselle.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead.
So I wanted to ask, it was wonderful talking to you, too. This is very interesting. How did you reclaim your indigenous roots? And did this help, develop your feminist identity? And then also, too, like, what guidance do you have for other individuals who are multicultural and growing up in the United States, in this culture?
Thanks for calling.
Well, I don't think it's so much, you know, with me to say that I discovered my indigenous roots. I mean, I think that, you know, I'm, you know, when I came into also in the 70s when I became involved. First, I mean, politically, I was first involved with the feminist movement, and then that was at that time predominantly, you know, white and middle class, upper middle class movement. And it was my really understanding that did not represent, you know, the specificity of my life, that I began to really get involved with Chicana feminism and women of color feminism. And there was a collection that came out, this bridge called My Back, that spoke to that.
My guest is Shireen Moraga. She's a writer and cultural activist. We're talking about her new memoir, Native Country of the Heart. If you'd like to join us, you can call 800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with writer, teacher, and cultural activist Shireen Moraga. Her new memoir is called Native Country of the Heart. Shireen, how did you realize, to the extent that you knew you would have to do something, that your mother's mind was failing?
Well, I mean, it was, you know, it takes the whole relationship with Alzheimer's in particular is that it takes several years to really know what's going on. And and my sister really was the one, because she lived closer, was kind of, you know, really being able to kind of measure this, you know, this kind of, you know, just the increasing loss of memory. And of course, first, it's short-term memory. And that gets confusing, because long-term stays a long time. Mm-hmm. So actually, what was kind of interesting is that in the later part of her life, I spoke mostly to her in Spanish, which was her original language. And then, you know, and she was completely fluent in English. So it's interesting, all of that process. And so it confuses you, because they have a long memory. And my mother would remember tremendous things and details about her, you know, childhood, et cetera. But the short term became really, really increasingly evident. And I think that my parents, the two of them, were living by themselves. And, you know, as I say, my mother was the one very much in charge. And so when she began, she wasn't able to cook anymore. And, I mean, all these kinds of things, like, you know, it just is, it's very, very obvious kinds of things begin to happen, and you know you can't deny what's going on, especially, you know, in our big family, everybody wanted to deny it because she was such a central part of the very heart of the family. And, you know, I think I really credit my sister because, you know, she had to make, you know, really, really hard decisions because she was the one seeing things. And so I would come down. I was constantly coming down from the Bay Area. And I think the most difficult part about dementia is when they know enough to know.
Yeah.
When they remember enough and know enough to know what's happening to them. And it's so, that's the hardest part because afterwards, when they don't know, it's not as painful. I mean, it's a painful for you, but it's not as painful for them, you know. And I think there's always the questions about always trying, you know. I think one of the biggest things that came up when I talk about in the book is that when you have learned so, so deeply to respect your elders, you know, I mean, that's a, like a strong cultural response. And then you have to decide that you know more than they do, you know, and it's really, really hard. And I always feel like whatever story my mom told, I just went with it. You know, I mean, I always wanted to any way possible, like, her dressing backwards or doing something, you know, and I go, oh, yeah, let me just adjust this for you, Mom. Like, in many ways, trying not to have her be aware. She was such a, you know, certain level, kind of beautifully vain person about her looks, you know. But it's just there's no easy way through it. I think I hope what I achieve in this book is also to understand that it actually is also a really important opportunity, you know, to become intimate with your elders, to receive what they can give you, to also understand that their bodies carry memory and that it's really, that you can read, learn to read their bodies and read what they're trying to tell you even when they begin. When my mother lasted long enough to lose most of her language, I mean, couldn't finish sentences, and she still recognized me, which was, you know, I always appreciated, but sometimes confuse you with other relations. And But it is, to me, you know, I referred to her as my Zen master, you know, that she was on a certain level teaching me that if the present moment is all you have, then that's all you have. And that's really true about life anyway, you know, that. And, you know, and it also kind of made me think about, you know, the ephemerality of our lives and that our personalities that we put so much into actually, you know, we eventually those go too. And so, you know, I'm not saying this in any way intellectually. I'm saying this deeply emotionally, you know, that I watched my mother's decline was a daily lesson to me about my own vulnerability, about my own, you know, my imminent death, my, you know, all of these important questions and then how I want them to, how I consider my children in that. And, anyway, so there's a way, and I don't mean this in any, you know, facile way, but there was a great lesson in it for me that I actually am grateful to her for, that ironically in her last years of her life, she was teaching me some of the hardest lessons that I have to learn.
Even when she could barely speak, you took like this extraordinary comfort because she would still call you Mija or Mijita. Can you talk about why those words mean so much to you?
Well, I mean, they mean my daughter, you know, my little daughter. And I think because, you know, when you say to somebody, you know, it's like Latinos will say that, especially Mexicanos, you'll be on that. Sometimes I forget and I call my students Mija, you know. It's like, I know I'm not supposed to do that, but if they're Latinos and I'm caring about them, I go, oh, Mija, you know, and I can see them soften, you know. Because there's such a, to say that, and you don't necessarily just do that for your son or daughter, you know, you do that for all your relations, you do that for people that, it's kind of like the, sometimes I would think of it as our larger pueblo, us as a people, you know, that is how we are linked sort of culturally. And it's such a, when somebody who doesn't, you don't feel that way with calls you mijo or mija, whatever like that, the kid knows it's wrong, you know, because it really is such a language of familiarity. It's a beautiful, beautiful expression to me. And I know that, you know, I guess because it was the word that was never, and for all of our English speaking, you know, as we lose Spanish along the way, it's like that expression will never leave, you know. And I see it passed down to even my daughter, who now, you know, she has her little boy and she refers to him as mijo, and even her Anglo husband calls him mijo, you know. And so there's a real beauty in that in terms of familia.
So at your mother's memorial service, your brother gives this, I guess, really impassioned eulogy and says really wonderful things and said a lot of the things that your mother really just longed to hear him say to her that he never could or never just never did. And it's a thing, and you had to kind of subtly confront him about it. And I get like those really like nuanced family tensions. I can kind of relate
right.
to. But I wondered, yes. did it bother you that he never could say these things your mother wanted to hear from him, or did it bother you that it wasn't enough for you to say those kinds of things to your mother?
Well, that's I think that's a really, really good question. You know, because I think that I felt like, you know, for my part, I was so loved by her. You know, I just, and in a certain level that I knew that, ironically, I know that she really loved my brother and she held him in great esteem, even when he hurt her so much, right? But I knew, you know, that I knew he never had from her what I had, you know. So I can't say it was that. I really have to say that, but I think your question is a very important one. I have to say it was really because she suffered so much because he never said he loved her, you know, because he never showed he loved her. And that really, really, really was a great, you know, Spanish is a llanto. It's like a great cry inside of her, you know. And sometimes I'd get so mad at her, you know, for still like, what, you know, for, you know, it's all right, you know, like that. But you could never repair that. He was the only one that could repair that. And so to me it was quite bitter that at her, you know, in a eulogy then, he says it, you know. That was really hard for me. It was really, really hard about the, you know, kind of, and it's sad. I mean, it's tragic. You know, I love my brother. I mean, it's like, but it's a tragedy, you know, that we can never say, for whatever the conditions in our life that keeps that, you know, from showing people how we really feel, you know. It's, to me, my mother, that was her cross to bear, that she lost her son. She felt she lost her son since he was, you know, quite young. And he walked a road away from her. He's, you know, he's doing fine. It's a good life, you know, but she never, she felt she lost him, you know, and I know my mother's particular feelings also about men, and the men in her life, and that, you know, that they were people she could not count on, and yet she was she really, really needed and loved men to, you know, for her to be approved of by them and to get their recognition, and most of the time did not get what she needed in that way, you know.
This is Think.
So it's sad. Yes.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Cherie, did your mother love your father?
Yes. Yeah, she loved him.
It's interesting because it does. I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
No, I'm just going to say, but did she want him? I think she wanted him at one point. Yes, I think she even wanted him at one point. Did she respect him? No.
Because he didn't stand up to her?
Yeah. I think on a certain level that was it, you know, that he needed her. And that he needed her and she needed, you know, and I'm saying this in the way my mother would understand it, you know, he needed her and she needed a man. And yet, you know, these are our contradictions, right? She, you know, but, and yet, you know, my mother was a person who was a survivor, you know, and so, you know, and this is a lament, I think, of many people in our relationships, right? And particularly in heterosexual relationships, that man you want may not exist for the kind of woman you are, you know? It just may not happen. And so I think with my mother, you know, in their later life, they had a very lovely relationship in many ways. You know, before she became ill, they were financially freer, you know, they to see him dance together, was very, you know, you thought it was a really beautiful relationship. But my mother was like, she held a lot of resentment for a long time, you know. And there was some ease in that in their later years. And that's why I say she loved him. She loved him. And I think when she was young, there was things she wanted from him and didn't get. And so, you know, that those kinds of betrayals are, you know, and when she almost died, she felt like she was very ill and he wasn't there for her. He fell apart. So once, you know, the person that you, particularly in our marriages, you know, it's like once that person is does not show up for you and you're going to die, those are things you, as my mother would say, you know, I may forgive, but I never forget, you know. And I think those kinds of things, I mean, those woundings in all of our lives, we never, oftentimes we never recover from them. So like the same way I'd said to you that my mother came through for me, when she said, you know, when I came out to her, she came through for me, which I would never forget. And so when my mother needed my father to come through for her, he didn't. And those, you know, so those are these kinds of wounds that we carry in our life. And my father's, you know, he's 95, he's doing fine, and I have a lot of affection for him, you know, but I do know that that was the case of their marriage, you know.
I was touched that you, as a storyteller yourself, noted that it was your father for a time who became the kind of repository of your mother's family's knowledge. Like he remembered things right. that as they were dying and losing their memories, couldn't remember anymore.
Right, yes. Yeah, he's a, you know, there was always a part of him. I mean, you know, he didn't finish high school. He got a GED and... But there was a part of him when he was a young man that he read a lot when he was a boy, and he loved history. So, and it's interesting because my father doesn't really speak Spanish, and when he does, it's the accent's so horrible that you tell him not to. But he was actually listening all the time to, there was, you know, I had a lot of aunties, a lot of tías, and they'd all sit around speaking English and Spanish and everything, and he was very close to my mother's brothers, and so he just really kept, his memory's fine. He kept really, really clear records in his historical mind of all these people and their relations and even dates and, you know, all of that. Even to this day, he's still, I can ask him a question and he'll, like when I was finishing this book, there'd be a few little chronologies that confused me. And then he goes, oh, no, that happened. And he could tell you, you know, chapter, line, and verse, you know, of it.
Shireen Moraga is a writer and cultural activist. Her new memoir is called Native Country of the Heart. Shireen, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for making time for us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it, too.
You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. You can use your favorite podcast app to subscribe at any time to the Think podcast and learn about upcoming shows we have planned at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.